We are undemocratic, then, in our religion, as is proved by our efforts to, quote, raise the poor. We are undemocratic in our government, as is proved by our innocent attempt to govern them well. But above all, we are undemocratic in our literature, as is proved by the torrent of novels about the poor and serious studies of the poor, which poor, from our publishers every month. And the more, quote, modern the book is, the more certain it is to be devoid of democratic sentiment. A poor man is a man who has not got much money. This may seem a simple and unnecessary description, but in the face of a great mass of modern fact and fiction, it seems very necessary indeed. Most of our realists and sociologists talk about a poor man as if he were an octopus or an alligator. There is no more need to study the psychology of poverty than to study the psychology of bad temper, or the psychology of vanity, or the psychology of animal spirits. A man ought to know something of the emotions of an insulted man, not by being insulted, but simply by being a man. And he ought to know something of the emotions of a poor man, not by being poor, but simply by being a man. Therefore, in any writer who is describing poverty, my first objection to him will be that he has studied his subject. A Democrat would have imagined it. A great many hard things have been said about religious slumming and political or social slumming, but surely the most despicable of all is artistic slumming. The religious teacher is at least supposed to be interested in the costermonger because he is a man. The politician is in some dim and perverted sense interested in the costermonger because he is a citizen. It is only the wretched writer who is interested in the costermonger merely because he is a costermonger. Nevertheless, so long as he is merely seeking impressions, or in other words, copy, his trade, though dull, is honest. But when he endeavors to represent that, he is describing the spiritual core of a costermonger, his dim vices and his delicate virtues. Then we must object that his claim is preposterous. We must remind him that he is a journalist and nothing else. He has far less psychological authority even than the foolish missionary, for he is in the literal and derisive sense a journalist, while the missionary is an eternalist. The missionary at least pretends to have a version of the man's lot for all time. The journalist only pretends to have a version of it from day to day. The missionary comes to tell the poor man that he is in the same condition with all men. The journalist comes to tell other people how different the poor man is from everybody else. If the modern novels about the slums, such as novels of Mr. Arthur Morrison, or the exceedingly able novels of Mr. Somerset Maugham, are intended to be a sensational, I can only say that it is a noble and reasonable object and that they attain it. A sensation, a shock to the imagination, like the contact with cold water, is always a good and exhilarating thing, and undoubtedly men will always seek this sensation, among other forms, in the form of the study of the strange antics of remote or alien peoples. In the 12th century, men obtained this sensation by reading about dog-headed men in Africa. In the 20th century, they obtained it by reading about pig-headed boars in Africa. The men of the 20th century were certainly, it must be admitted, somewhat the more credulous of the two. For it is not recorded of the men in the 12th century that they organized a sanguinary crusade solely for the purpose of altering the singular formation of the heads of the Africans. But it may be, and it may even legitimately be, that since all these monsters have faded from the popular mythology, it is necessary to have in our fiction the image of the horrible and hairy East Ender, merely to keep alive in us a fearful and childlike wonder at external peculiarities. But the Middle Ages, with a great deal more common sense than it would now be fashionable to admit, regarded natural history at bottom rather as a kind of joke. They regarded the soul as very important. Hence, while they had a natural history of dog-headed men, they did not profess to have a psychology of dog-headed men. They did not profess to mirror the mind of a dog-headed man, to share his tenderest secrets, or mount with his most celestial musing. They did not write novels about the semi-canine creature, attributing to him all the oldest morbidities and all the newest fads. It is permissible to present men as monsters if we wish to make the reader jump, and to make anybody jump is always a Christian act. But it is not permissible to present men as regarding themselves as monsters or as making themselves to jump. To summarize, our slum fiction is quite defensible as aesthetic fiction. It is not defensible as spiritual fact. One enormous obstacle stands in the way of its actuality. The men who write it and the men who read it are men of the middle classes or the upper classes, at least of those who are loosely termed the educated classes. Hence, the fact that it is the life as the refined man sees it proves that it cannot be the life as the unrefined man lives it. Rich men write stories about poor men and describe them as speaking with a coarse or heavy or husky enunciation. But if poor men wrote novels about you or me, they would describe us as speaking with some absurd, shrill, and affected voice, such as we only hear from a duchess in a three-act farce. The slum novelist gains his whole effect by the fact that some detail is strange to the reader. But that detail, by the nature of the case, cannot be strange in itself. It cannot be strange to the soul which he is professing to study. The slum novelist gains his effects by describing the same gray mist as draping the dingy factory and the dingy tavern. But to the man he is supposed to be studying, there must be exactly the same difference between the factory and the tavern that there is to a middle-class man between a late night at the office and a supper at Putgiani's. The slum novelist is content with pointing out that to the eye of his particular class, a pickaxe looks dirty and a pewter pot looks dirty. But the man he is supposed to be studying sees the difference between them exactly as a clerk sees the difference between a ledger and an edition deluxe. The chiaroscuro of the life is inevitably lost, for to us the highlights and the shadows are a light gray. But the highlights and the shadows are not a light gray in that life any more than in any other. The kind of man who could really express the pleasures of the poor would be also the kind of man who could share them. In short, these books are not a record of the psychology of poverty. They are a record of the psychology of wealth and culture when brought in contact with poverty. They are not a description of the state of the slums. They are only a very dark and dreadful description of the state of the slummers. One might give innumerable examples of the essentially unsympathetic and unpopular qualities of these realistic writers, but perhaps the simplest and most obvious example with which we could conclude is the mere fact that these writers are realistic. The poor have many other vices, but at least they are never realistic. The poor are melodramatic and romantic in grain. The poor all believe in high moral platitudes and copybook maxims. Probably this is the ultimate meaning of the great saying, "Blessed are the poor." Blessed are the poor, for they are always making life or trying to make life like an Aldefi play. Some innocent educationalists and philanthropists, or for even philanthropists can be innocent, have expressed a grave astonishment that the masses prefer shilling shockers to scientific treatises and melodramas to problem plays. The reason is very simple. The realistic story is certainly more artistic than the melodramatic story. If what you desire is deft handling, delicate proportions, a unit of artistic atmosphere, the realistic story has a full advantage over the melodrama. In everything that is light and bright and ornamental, the realistic story has a full advantage over the melodrama. But at least the melodrama has one indisputable advantage over the realistic story. The melodrama is much more like life. It is much more like man, and especially the poor man. It is very banal and very inartistic when a poor woman at the Adelphi says, "Do you think I will sell my own child?" But poor women in the Battersea High Road do say, "Do you think I will sell my own child?" They say it on every available occasion. You can hear a sort of murmur or babble of it all the way down the street. It is very stale and weak dramatic art, if that is all, when the workman confronts his master and says, "I'm a man." But a workman does say, "I'm a man," two or three times every day. In fact, it is tedious, possibly, to hear poor men being melodramatic behind the footlights. But that is because one can always hear them being melodramatic in the street outside. In short, melodrama, if it is dull because it is too accurate. Somewhat the same problem exists in the case of stories about schoolboys. Mr. Kipling's Stalky and Company is much more amusing, if you are talking about amusement, than the late Dean Farrar's Eric or Little by Little, but Eric is immeasurably more like real school life. For real school life, real boyhood, is full of the things of which Eric is full: priggishness, a crude piety, a silly sin, a weak but continual attempt at the heroic, in a word, melodrama. And if we wish to lay a firm basis for any efforts to help the poor, we must not become realistic and see them from the outside. We must become melodramatic and see them from the inside. The novelist must not take out his notebook and say, "I, a man expert." No, he must imitate the workman in the Adelphi play. He must slap himself on the chest and say, "I am a man."